Six Music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Breakdown, baby.
And welcome. I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music, where we speak to some of music's most influential figures about the pivotal first moments and songs that shaped their lives and careers, the events and tracks that led them to be who and where they are today. DJ Shadow has to be one of the most important figures in electronic music. His groundbreaking use of sampling and production changed hip-hop. It took it in new experimental directions and opened it up to unexpected stylistic influences and attracted new artists to the genre. Born Josh Davis, Shadow's breakthrough 1996 album Introducing brought together underground hip-hop, cut-and-paste beats and samples from films, psychedelia, jazz and soul. It proved a watershed not just for electronic music culture, but all popular music. Echoes of its rhythms can still be heard clearly today. From there, he's continued to make immaculately crafted, sonically interesting albums. Never content to tread the same path twice, his music has evolved and developed and kept him as relevant as ever. He's a reluctant interviewee who rarely enjoys discussing his motives or his music, so I was enormously pleased to get some time with Josh. We talked about his early childhood influences, his forays into creating music. He used to make tracks on an old double tape deck when he was a kid, his explorations into early hip-hop and his relationship with Mo Wax, the label that brought him fame. We also talked about the huge success of Introducing, his work with Tom York and the Uncle Project, and his brand new album, The Less You Know The Better. And I started, as I always do on the first time, with asking him the question, when was the first time he was aware of music?
Well, I suppose because I grew up in the early 70s, well, I mean, those are my earliest memories, the records that my family had, and also just, you know, being in the car and having music played. It seems like when I grew up, I was constantly shuttling back and forth between my two parents because they were separated at the time. So there was always about a 3-hour drive between them, and it seemed like I was always in the car. And my father's listening habits were tended to be kind of what at that time would have been oldies. So we're talking music from the 50s and 60s. And my mother's taste was whatever was contemporary. So, you know, I recall just that sort of nebulous mid-70s pop rock and then into the disco era.
What about the first, I don't know, I suppose it would be contemporary record, the first time there was some music that kind of you found for you that spoke to you? Because obviously kids get influenced by their parents' stuff, but there's that thing when you think, this is my artist.
Yeah, well, the first music that I remember going to a I think it was my birthday possibly when I was about 7, and I remember being in a really crowded department store, and either my grandparents or my mother asking me, you know, okay, you can pick one record or tape. Tapes were just becoming kind of popular then, and it was Devo's first album was the first thing that I spent my own money on. I think it was sort of like, okay, you have, you know, $7 you can spend. What are you going to buy in the whole store?
What was it that appealed about Devo? It's a very cool first choice.
I liked music. I liked disco, actually. I liked stuff like Funky Town by Lips Incorporated. You know, I liked stuff that, in my mind, sounded like, you know, something they could listen to in Star Wars. I think, like most kids at that age, it was, you know, the future, it's science fiction, technology, that was all very exciting. And I liked music that seemed to represent that rather than representing what my parents liked.
We are Devo. Are we not Miss? Devo. Are we not Miss? Devo. first hip-hop record that you heard?
Well, I had heard records like Rapper's Delight, but to me they were, to my sort of 6-7-year-old, well, let's see, no, 1979, yeah, 7-8-year-old brain, it sounded kind of like disco or like a novelty record as well, and it was in a sense. As long as people were rapping over live instruments, to me it didn't seem different enough. But The Message by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five was the first kind of electro hip-hop record that I heard. And I mean, somewhere I've got a cassette of me recording it. I mean, you know, I had a little a portable cassette deck that I had to put up to a little AM radio speaker to record my music. And that's how I recorded things like, you know, Cars by Gary Numan or Blondie, Rapture, anything that seemed contemporary and fresh. And I was recording it, but it was after bedtime, so my mother comes in and was going, "What are you listening to?" You know, and I'm like, "Shh." So there's a recording of that somewhere on one of my old cassettes. But that was the summer of '82, and it was followed within a few weeks by Planet Rock by Afrika Bambaataa. So those were the first two that, you know, and it coincided with these little hints on the news about things like breakdancing and graffiti. And I remember seeing an early news report about the Human Beatbox from, at the time they were called Disco 3, not the Fat Boys, but it was just a street corner New York phenomenon. It seemed like it was a million miles away, but that attracted it to me as well.
It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. My brother's doing fast on my mother's TV. Says she watches too much. It's just not healthy. All my children in the daytime, Dallas at night. Can't even see the game or the Sugar Ray fight. The bill collectors, they ring my phone and scare my wife when I'm not home. Got a bum education, double-digit inflation. Can't take the train to the job. There's a strike at the station. Neon King Kong standing on my back. Can't stop to turn around. Broke my sacroiliac, a mid-range migraine, cancer membrane. Sometimes I think I'm going insane. I swear I might hijack a plane. Don't push me. Call, close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
Of mind, blind to the ways of mankind. God is smiling on you, but he's frowning too, because only God knows what you'll go through. You'll grow in the ghetto, living second rate, and your eyes will sing a song of deep hate. The places you play and where you stay looks like one great big alleyway. You'll admire all the number book takers, thugs, pimps, and pushers, and the big money makers, driving big cars, spending 20s and 10s, and you want to grow up to be just like them. Smugglers, scramblers, burglars, gamblers, pickpocket peddlers, even panhandlers. You say, "I'm cool, I'm no fool," but then you wind up dropping out of high school. Now you're unemployed, all non-void, walking around like your pretty boy Floyd. Turned stick-up kid, but look what you done did. Got sent up for an 8-year bid. Now your manhood is took and you're a Maytag. Spend the next 2 years as an undercover fag, being used and abused to serve like hell, till one day you was found hung dead in a cell. But now your eyes sing the sad, sad song of how you live so fast and die so young. So don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
What was the kind of music scene in California where you grew up? What was it like? Was it a predominantly kind of rock club scene? And which obviously maybe why this New York street kind of seems so appealing.
Yeah, well, I grew up near Sacramento in the Sacramento Valley in the Central Valley of California. And so the San Francisco scene, you know, loomed large over everything. There was no Sacramento scene per se. I mean, everything was
nothing.
Well, I mean, actually, it's for a city of its size, it's a massive underperformer when it comes to music. I mean, the only real, and I don't mean that in any kind of derogatory way. It's just it is kind of perplexing for this a city of its size. We did manage to squeeze out a few good garage rock gems in the late 60s. But again, it was these were groups that were trying to break into San Francisco and what was happening there. So by the time I was growing up listening to radio in the Sacramento area, it was the main rock station was KZAP. And it was, you know, it actually was a pretty progressive station. I mean, they would do, you know, a lot of kind of intellectual rock of the time, almost prog, but, you know, it had to be a little more pop, you know, like Golden Earring or Emerson, Lake and Palmer, groups like that, you know.
Proggy, definitely proggy.
Pretty proggy, but also had a very firm, you know, I remember being bemused by this top 100 countdown they would do every year, I think around New Year's. And I think the 3 years that I listened, the number one each time was Stairway to Heaven.
Still, every year.
Yeah,
every
exactly.
Year.
And I remember thinking, well, that's not very, you know, that certainly isn't, I think, the spirit that, in other words, I think that their prime had sort of passed them. So there really wasn't much else to listen to other than I would listen to KFRC from San Francisco, an AM station that was breaking groups like Jefferson Airplane in the mid-60s, but by that time had switched to what's known as an urban format. So it was Kool & the Gang, Gap Band, Lakeside, and that's what I was listening to, because again, it wasn't this kind of, oh, let's keep things frozen in 1970 or 71. It was, you know, this was music that was really progressive at that time.
Could you pick a track by one of those artists that you just mentioned?
Yeah, you could play something like what I remember playing on a loop this whole era was You Dropped a Bomb on Me by the Gap Band.
So you mentioned your kind of early forays into taping stuff off the radio. What were your first sort of proper recordings in terms of pieces of music? Do you remember what those were like?
Well, In 1984, well, let's see. Yeah, Christmas of 84, I had asked for something that my older brother had for a few years prior, which was one of those combination turntable radio station dual cassette deck. I found that if I held the little selector knob between cassette and phono, that I could actually overdub. If I was recording from cassette to cassette, I could overdub the turntable on top of it by holding the selector knob just barely, and I had to hold it, I couldn't leave it. And so I started practicing with overdubbing and multi-tracking, and true to form, the first thing that I experimented with was the Charlie Brown Christmas record that we had.
That, which is Vince Guaraldi, which is a brilliant record.
True, although this was, in this case, it was dialogue and music. So I think I remember this thing where I experimented doing this echo effect with Lucy's voice by recopying and playing her voice slightly later each time, so that actually it was kind of a building up effect, because the more passes that I did, the earlier ones would get more and more degraded. So the effect was sort of like a reverse echo, so it'd be like that, 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 louder and louder. That was the first thing I remember doing, and then at that time I was just starting to kind of have enough allowance money from doing chores or whatever and also from selling my comic book collection, I was able to start buying 12 inches.
I want to ask you what your first sample was, but I guess you've kind of answered that really, haven't you? The first time you sampled it, because you kind of did that in a kind of lo-fi way with that.
Yeah, I mean, but there were, I guess, yeah, but the first beats that I remember kind of finding on my own were actually in my dad's collection. He had a Paul Butterfield Blues Band album that had a breakbeat on it that hadn't been used. And this is, again, 86, 87, when at a time when sampling in the way that we know it now was just starting to happen. I mean, it was still mostly overdubs from turntables that people were using. I mean, even records like Peter Piper by Run-DMC, that's not a sample per se. It's just a drum machine going and Jam Master Jay scratching the break over the top of it. So, yeah, I mean, 87 and then 88, as groups like Public Enemy became much more sophisticated with their sampling, when It Takes a Nation of Millions came out and they sampled Isaac Hayes off the Hot Buttered Soul album, which is an album, again, that my dad had.
They were suckers. They wanted me for their army or whatever. Picture me giving a damn. I said never. Here's a land that never gave a damn about a brother like me and myself, because they never did. I wasn't with it, but just that very minute it occurred to me. The suckers had authority.
Hearing, you know, oh, they used that and I know what it is, it made me feel as though I was somehow in tune with what was going on musically with everybody else.
You were part of something.
Yeah. I felt, because, you know, it has to be understood for anybody under 30 that's listening to this, that, you know, before the internet, this all this record knowledge was secret and sacred. You know, it was, DJs used to cover up the labels of the records to make sure other DJs wouldn't steal, you know, their secret break information. And that was a treasured tradition. And yeah, I mean, it was having the ability to recognize these samples as they were happening in real time became quite a window into, oh, maybe I can do this.
When did you first meet James Lavelle?
Lavelle had heard a subsequent record I had done called The Legitimate Mix, which was on an EP for a group called Zimbabwe Legit, a hip-hop group from Africa, and he had heard it played, I think, his second ever trip to the States. He went to DJ in L.A. for a guy named Orlando that was throwing these parties based on the kind of Giles Peterson Talking Loud aesthetic. Acid jazz, I suppose you'd say. And for better or worse, that was the scene James was aligned with at that point, and so he was invited to come DJ, and he heard Orlando play this track that I had done, and it was all instrumental. It was really down-tempo. It was very kind of free-form in the way it was put together. And I think he heard it about 6 months after it came out, and it took him about 3 to 6 months to actually track me down. I think he mentioned me on the telephone with an A&R guy, Tommy Boy, who I was sending cassettes to. And I knew him really well, this guy, his name is Albie Ragusa. And I think Lavelle was just like, yeah, there's this record, this guy, Shadow. And Albie was like, oh, I know Shadow, here's his number. So I got a call one day, you know, I was in my second or third year of college, and this guy calling me up from England. And it wasn't, I think, as unusual or left field as some people have thought it might have been for me, because I was already reading NME and Melody Maker and Soul Underground and these other publications from the UK, because they were covering hip-hop. No magazines in the States were until The Source, which was, you know, unobtainable for me until my first year of college. So all through the late 80s, I was reading UK magazines to read about hip-hop. There was a record store on Haight Street in San Francisco that my father would take me to, and they specialized in imports, and I would try and get these records as I was able.
So what was your first release allied to the kind of Moax banner, I suppose? What would that be?
That was Influx, a 12-inch.
What was the reaction like to that?
I think the reaction was, well, it was exactly what James was looking for, and it was exactly, you know, he was... The first four or five records on Moax, I think if you look at their catalog, are very much this sort of... it's like Talking Loud Jr. or something. And that's not to diminish what he was doing, and I think he would agree with that assessment of it. But I knew from the time I had spent with him in our telephone conversations that he was craving a different sound, and he just... I don't think it was until he heard that legitimate mix that I was referring to that he knew what he was trying to do. Because he didn't want to do straight hip-hop, because for whatever reason, I don't think he felt qualified or knowledgeable enough possibly in that genre to foray into it. And I think other labels like Cold Sweat and Music of Life were doing it better in the UK, I think, than he could have done. But he wanted something that was hip-hop influenced. And... the record came out, and it seemed to definitely define Moax and separate Moax from the other labels that were doing other more, I don't know, whatever, acid jazzy stuff. But, you know, because there was nothing to call it yet, a lot of people just said, oh, this is a new direction in acid jazz. And the first time I came to the UK in 93, I was asked a lot about that scene, and I just was like, I'm sorry, I have no clue what that is, or I mean, I knew what it was in the sense of being informed as a record consumer, but I did have to fight against it for a while, because I was very uncomfortable with any sort of tag other than hip-hop, because that's all I grew up listening to and wanting to contribute to.
The song about life, death, love, hate, wealth, poverty, racism, just a few things been running through my head.
Listen! We call on you. Listen. Now we call on you.
That was DJ Shadow talking about Influx, one of his earliest releases, recorded with the Groove Robbers back in 1993.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
to talk about Introducing, 1996. In terms of making an impact, that really did make a massive impact. Gathering fans that maybe normally wouldn't have been introduced to that kind of music, and that level of very high production, very precise, lots and lots of work. People from, you know, people that went to guitar bands got very much into that record. Everyone got into that record. I mean, how did you first react when you started to get these critical plaudits? Because it took you years to make it on and off, didn't it? It was, yeah, sure. It was a long time.
Yeah, and there was a lot of things going through my head at that time. I mean, on one hand, there was this, you know, by 95, late 94, early 95, I don't know if you recall in the weeklies, I can't remember if it was Melody Maker or NME, that they started to have a section, I think, called Heads or something. Or it was something like that, a way of covering the type of music that labels like Mo Wax were doing and Ninja Tune were doing. And it was very much a legitimate, like, okay, this is something we're going to cover on a consistent basis from now on. And as the press did at that time, because everything was so fast moving, the term trip hop had stuck, and you know, you had certain compilations that, like, this is Trip Hop Volume 2. And for what it's worth, I would always refuse to have my music associated with those, because I didn't, for the same reason as acid jazz. I remember having a palpable sense in the summer of 95 that I may have missed the boat.
Really?
Because Portishead's album came out.
Great record.
Absolutely. Tricky had a big record out that summer. And I remember feeling like, oh man, did I screw up in not, you know, putting the album out this year? Because I did an EP called What Does Your Soul Look Like, which was like 33 minutes. And that, to be completely honest, was my album in process. I mean, I was working on an album. And Mo Wax felt strongly at that time that it would make more sense to put out an EP and keep growing things rather than do an album. And I remember kind of going, okay, but this is 33 minutes. It took a really long time to make, you know. Are we sure we want to just sort of put that out and then I'm going to have to start all over again? But that's what we did. And so anyway, the summer of 96 came along and the record came out. But really sort of a shame, I suppose, in one sense, is that I never did get that sense of critical acclaim, because it came out and I went home back to the States, where nobody knew what I was doing or who I was. And I remembered feeling like, well, wow, you know, I worked a long time, put out this record. I knew that people liked it, but I had no, it wasn't like an instant success. It was a slow burn. And it took like a year, really, for it to, and it took a good 6 months for that kind of tidal wave to come back to the States. But I was very naive and unaware of all that stuff.
Insight, foresight, more sight. The clock on the wall reads a quarter past midnight.
Think about it and understand it.
Oh, approaching midnight.
You produced the first Uncle album, Science Fiction. I remember there being this enormous excitement before that record came out for the collaborators on it.
Sure.
How it very much it was expected to be this is a distillation of everything that Moak's been doing, James have been doing, and you'd been doing. Did you feel like there was quite a lot of pressure? Because it was almost like there was no way the record could live up to the expectations. It did feel, this is going to be the biggest record of all time.
Well, I was spared most of the pressure until, I'd say, the last... Well, maybe that's not completely accurate. No, I did feel pressure, yeah.
It's going to be like, yeah, oh, well, we got Tom York coming in later, okay.
But
and then Mike D's coming, okay.
Well, but the thing to bear in mind, of course, is that Tom York wasn't Tom York then. Richard Ashcroft wasn't necessarily Richard Ashcroft then. It wasn't like... I mean, these were bands that had one or possibly at the most two albums out. Well, Radiohead definitely had two albums out. But, you know, OK Computer hadn't come out when we did the stuff. So it was... There was a lot of... I did feel pressure in the sense that I definitely had a sense from A&M, who had picked up Moax at that point, that this was something that was extremely important. And I sort of went from being a bedroom DJ to working in world-class studios with, frankly, world-class talent rather quickly. But I kind of lapped it up. I mean, it wasn't really until the last few months when I was getting, you know, James and my relationship was starting to strain a little bit just from, I think, the pressure he was getting. And I sort of felt like, well, look, there's nothing more I really have to say or do in the studio at this point. I mean, the record is what it is. And I felt, you know, no sense of like, oh, you know, we need to have a good single. I just didn't think that way then. And I try not to now, honestly. It's just, I knew that the music was special, particularly, you know, the tracks with the big names, so to speak.
Rub It In Your Headlights is something that you've said as being one of your favorite pieces of work, and it is an incredible track.
Yeah.
Were you a big Radiohead fan anyway? Or?
Well, no. I mean, in the sense that I heard Creep when it was on MTV.
That's it.
And I had heard there were a couple of the slower tracks from the Bends that had actually had some traction in the Bay Area. They weren't who they ended up becoming. They weren't the greatest band on the planet yet. They were just a group that one of many who were doing interesting things at that time, pre-Britpop, whatever you want to call it. I had a lot of respect for them, and I knew that, OK Computer, we heard on a cassette, you know, an advanced promo cassette. But that record, I remember thinking, wow, this is, you know, this is good, like really good. I hope it does well, was what I remember thinking.
I'm a rabbit in your headlights, scared of the spotlight. You don't come to visit, I'm stuck in this bed.
you're frightened of dying, and you're holding on. You see devils tearing your life away. But if you've made your peace, then the devils are really angels, freeing you from the earth.
When did you first start making The Less You Know The Better?
The process for the new album started in earnest in early 09, but seriously in late 09. So, I mean, I started kind of, okay, I'm just going to, you know, start working slowly and, you know, ease myself into it, because I had been on the road almost nonstop since The Outsider came out. Doing two completely different projects, and felt like I kind of needed a break. But so I just went out, did a few record trips, and then started slowly piecing things together. But it always amazes me how important those early kind of unofficial work sessions can be.
What do you mean?
Well, many of the tracks have roots from those, that 1 month that I started and then got diverted to other things, and then a few months later came back, okay, I'll work for another couple weeks. And so many of those early elements of like, oh, that I like what that's saying, you know, I like what musically what that's doing and what that represents in my world. It's just, it's really important. And but then when I got serious about working on the record, it was very immersive. You know, I was working away from home in a little one-bedroom cottage in the middle of a town that I was unfamiliar with, rural environment, and with the express purpose of, like, okay, waking up, working, going to sleep, waking up, working, going to sleep. It's how I think I need to work from now on, because it was so productive. I mean, I feel like this record is much more focused, and I feel like the effort shows more than most records I've made.
There does seem to be, can I use the word concept? I can use the word concept. There does seem to be a concept behind the record, the ethos, I guess, of the record, reading some of the literature that you've come with it. There does seem to be, there's a point that I think you're trying to communicate. Is that right?
Well, there is. In a how do we put this music out in 2011 and not let it get washed under the bridge of anonymity? Yeah. I mean, I think that unfortunately in the world that we live in, you know, putting out a record is advertising. I mean, if you want to tell people about it and have, posters on the street or a billboard on, in, you know, the odd roundabout in London or whatever, that's advertising in the same way that you're advertising phones or, you know. And I think people are so bombarded with advertising that I took it upon myself to try and come up with a campaign that would be evocative, if nothing else, and would be hard for people to ignore. And for no other reason than, you know, I want people to hear this music. I want it to mean something to people in the way that it used to mean something to people, not just with my music, but music in general. I'm extremely dismayed at this feeling that I think is palpable among my peers that, you know, what's the point? Nobody's ever going to hear this stuff. You know what I mean? How can you, yeah, you put your stuff online, but there's 10 billion songs online. How are you ever going to distinguish yourself? And so as a result, everybody, you know, is constantly tweeting and retweeting other people's compliments about themselves, which I think reduces artists to like used car salesmen and, you know, soft, you know, doing some sort of tap dance on the street corner for change. You know, it's just, it's become very
devalued
and indistinguished. And you know, it's not about money. It's not about, you know, free downloads or this and that. It's just that do people care? And I think it's obviously I'm concerned about it. This is not only my chosen profession, but it's also my passion. You know, I love reading about music. I love learning from others. I love being inspired by other people. And I think it's absolutely true on a certain level that there's a sense that do people care? You know, I think that's what the campaign, in for lack of a better term, is trying to gently suggest. I don't want to be on a soapbox, and I don't want to be, here's what I think needs to change, and, you know. So rather than go into any of that, I'm just satirizing what it's like to be an artist in 2011, and that's what it's about. I'm the joke. I'm the one being made fun of, and I'd rather take that tack than, again, being on a soapbox.
we've had all these firsts, and the last thing we're going to do is the last. It's the last track. You get to pick the last track.
Snoopy versus the Red Baron by the Royal Guardsmen. Pull that one up out of the file.
We shall play that. It's good to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
After the turn of the century, in the clear blue skies over Germany, came a roar and a thunder men have never heard, like the screaming sound of a big war bird. Up in the sky, a man in a plane, Baron von Richthofen was his name. 80 men tried, and 80 men countryside. 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 or more, the bloody Red Baron was rolling up the score. 80 men died trying to end that spree of the bloody Red Baron of Germany. In the nick of time, a hero arose, a funny looking dog with a big black nose. He flew into the sky to seek revenge, but the Baron shot him down.
Curses filed again.
10, 20, 30, 40, 50 or more, the bloody Red Baron was rolling up the score. 80 men died trying to end that spree of the bloody Red Baron of Germany. Now Snoopy had sworn that he'd get that man, so he asked the great challenged the German to a real dog fight. While the Baron was laughing, he got him in his sight. Spinning out of sight. 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 or more, the bloody Red Baron was rolling up the score. 80 men died trying to end that spree of the bloody Red Baron of Germany.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
I could try to say I'm sorry, but that won't be quiet enough to let you know pain that I feel, and it just won't let up. Oh, it feels like the sky is falling and the clouds are closing in.
Night, and we see reflect. It lingers, lingers without a sound.
This is BBC.
BBC Radio.
Six music. Right now, this is Handpicked.
Hello, this is a shorter version of a weekly new music playlist titled Handpicked by Six Music, one of a big collection of music playlists you can now download and subscribe to in the BBC Sounds app. To find the full version, just search Handpicked and check out some of the other playlists tailored for whatever music you need or mood you're in.
Less to say, working hard.